Hello there. Today is Friday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. takes action on Syria.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
The Senate forces a historic rules change to get the president's Supreme Court nominee confirmed. The chair of the House committee investigating Russia's influence in our presidential election steps aside.
It will, I think, allow us to have a fresh start moving forward.
Also ahead, a recap of the American Country Music Awards. Well, the United States has attacked a Syrian airbase with roughly 60 cruise missiles in response to a chemical weapons attack it blames on Syrian President Bashar Assad. President Trump made a statement following the strikes.
On Tuesday, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians. Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
U.S. officials say Syrian government aircraft killed dozens of civilians by using a nerve agent, possibly sarin, earlier this week. Thursday's bombing represents President Donald Trump's most dramatic military order since taking office. Joining me now for some analysis, Professor Ayman Saikal, director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us, sir, on short notice. What is your initial reaction to these actions?
I think this was needed a long time ago. And of course, President Obama had said in 2013 that if Syrian government crosses the red line, then the United States will take action. But of course, at the end, he backed down. And that also opened the way for Russia to come in and support the Assad regime and, of course, also assist the Iranians and Hezbollah in support of the Assad regime. I think now President Trump has done what perhaps President Obama should have done in 2013. And I think this could really change the picture to some extent because the Syrian people and, of course, more importantly, the Syrian rebels have had no cover against the regime's air force. And these cruise missiles could really affect the air strikes capability of the Assad regime.
What do you think the world's reaction will be tomorrow when people wake up to hear this news?
Well, obviously, I think those who are supporting the Assad regime, they are going to be very much alarmed, and the Russians and, of course, the Iranians, as well as the Hezbollah. But on the other hand, all the Arab countries have opposed the Assad regime, and also the United States and its allies in the past had opposed the Assad regime, although the Trump administration just a week ago was prepared to really change its mind and to say that, look, the Assad regime could have a future in any Syrian settlement. But of course, the chemical weapons attacks on the Syrian civilians have really changed the attitudes of the Trump administration.
Right. And it's interesting because before Donald Trump was president, when Obama was considering doing this thing, then Citizen Trump was tweeting, don't do it, don't do it, stay out of Syria. And so obviously it changes a lot once you get into the office and you see the magnitude of what is upon you.
That's absolutely true. But whether this cruise missiles attacks are going to be followed by more attacks on the part of the United States and whether they're going to also hit a number of other targets which could possibly cripple the military capability of the Syrian regime. But on the other hand, there is also a risk involved, and that it means that the United States may either accidentally or deliberately target some of the bases which are also being used used by the Russians and, of course, also by the other supporters of the Assad regime, and that could really escalate the conflict and the possibility of a conflict between the United States and Russia exists. It would be interesting to learn whether the United States had given a pre-warning to the Russians, because we know that President Trump is very much interested in maintaining good relationship with Russia. But I'm pretty sure that if the United States engages in more military actions, then they would be in touch with the Russians to make sure that there is no possibility of a direct confrontation between the two major players in Syria.
Is this enough? They just stopped here and did what they did?
I don't think this is going to be really enough in terms of really crippling or causing the downfall of the Assad regime, because I think these are, these bombardments are directed to specific targets, and the Syrian regime and, of course, their international backers, they do have considerable amount of resources to continue to unleash against the rebels and possibly also some of the distrusted civilian segments of the population. But if the current attacks is followed by further actions, then obviously that could easily change the overall equation on the ground and change the whole picture. And I think at that point, probably the Russians will press for a political settlement more seriously than has been the case up to this point.
All right, that's Amin Saikal, Director for the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Donald Trump and President Xi begin a highly anticipated summit in Florida. The U.S. issues a travel alert for Kenya. Environmentalists alarmed over Trump's plan to cancel the Chesapeake Bay program. Astronaut John Glenn laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. The U.S. Senate is poised to confirm President Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick after Republicans forced a historic change in the rules governing the chamber, ending the Democratic minority party's ability to block high court nominees. After days of finger-pointing and furious rhetoric, Republicans used their majority to exercise what's known as the nuclear option to push through confirmation of Judge Gorsuch. Joining me now to talk more about this is legal and political commentator James Goodnow. Thanks for being with us. So how will this impact things going forward?
This is going to have a dramatic impact on the Supreme Court and the Senate generally in the way it operates. So we know that on Thursday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell stood up in front of the Senate and made the motion to change the rules that allowed confirmation of Judge Gorsuch by a simple majority. That means on Friday, the Senate will come together and hold their vote. With the 51 votes that you have, certainly just with the 52 Republicans in the Senate, Judge Gorsuch will be confirmed. We also know that probably a few Democrats, as many as three, will also vote for him. This is a watershed moment for the court. This means that in the future, any judge can be confirmed with a simple majority. So this has a huge impact. This means that presidents can nominate judges, and if in fact the president is of the same party that controls the Senate, those judges will be confirmed without bipartisanship. You can have judges that are much more extreme ascending to the bench. That means you're going to have opinions that likely will be more extreme. That means you'll likely have campaign promises for judges that will be more extreme. And ultimately, the loser here is the American public, in that they won't have mainstream decisions. It becomes much more politicized in a way that was never intended. The judiciary is supposed to be the branch of government that is most insulated from politics. We know if you go all the way back to the 1780s, Alexander Hamilton said, the independence of the judiciary is critical to the functioning of a constitutional democracy. Well, What just happened with this nuclear option being deployed is we have interjected a new high level of politics into the Supreme Court, which means we'll have a more divided court, a more divided Senate, and ultimately a more divided country.
The Republicans would argue that the Democrats blocked this nomination out of spite because Republicans refused to even give President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. They wouldn't even give him a hearing because they feel like this was a stolen seat. So that's their argument. What say you?
Well, what we've seen really is an escalating of tensions over the last several years. If you go back to 2013, that's really where this beef started. Harry Reid, then Senate Majority Leader when the Democrats were in control of the Senate, made the decision to invoke the minor nuclear option, which is to say that lower court federal judges can be confirmed with a simple majority. Well, that really ticks Republicans off, and that in part, at least, is what led to Merrick Garland not getting even a confirmation hearing, which, of course, raised the stakes even higher and took us to the point where we had that nuclear button being pushed here. So there's plenty of blame to go around here. That blame goes on both sides of the aisle. It's unfortunate that it's gotten to this point. There were several senators that were trying to broker a compromise. It didn't happen. We know right now the country is divided. And what you saw from Democrats is that they felt that they have to filibuster so they can go back to their constituents, they can go back to their base, look them in the eye, and say, we tried. We tried at every step of the way to stop Donald Trump. We tried not to collaborate with Republicans, and gosh darn it, it just wasn't enough. Same is true on the other side of the aisle. Republicans right now desperately need a political win. We know it's been trip, stumble, and delay since the very beginning here of the Trump administration. So you had these strong political reasons on both sides of the aisle that ultimately led to this change in the Senate rules and change of the court.
All right, that's legal and political commentator James Goodnow. Thanks for being with us. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, is temporarily stepping down from the panel's investigation into alleged Russian hacking during the 2016 election campaign after ethical complaints were lodged against him. The House Ethics Committee is investigating whether Nunes has made or may have made an unauthorized disclosure of classified information last month during a hastily arranged news conference. His actions in recent weeks and close ties to the president have led to questions of whether he can fairly lead the investigation. Ranking member of the committee, Representative Adam Schiff, had this to say.
It is, I think, worth noting that the investigation never went into hiatus. So we've been continuing to develop our witness list, to work out some of the logistics in terms of how we bring people before the committee. We continue to go through the documents.
Well, joining me now to explain exactly what happened is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, I know you were on Capitol Hill as it was happening. What did you learn?
So on the last day of Congress, before a two-week spring recess, Devin Nunes dropped this big surprise that he didn't even forewarn his House Intelligence Committee members, colleagues, about. He's stepping away, recusing himself from the Russia investigation, but retaining his chairmanship of the House Intelligence Committee. Now, of course, this comes after weeks of chaos and questions and controversy over Nunes's role. He came out and said that he had viewed these documents on White House grounds, looking at the information that he said somewhat proved President Trump's tweeted claim that he had been put under wiretap surveillance by President Obama. Of course, the blowback to that claim and Devin Nunes's actions was quite fierce, especially from the Democratic side. And he finally decided to step away right before this two-week recess, I think mostly just to be able to minimize some of the media controversy and discussion. Now he has, you know, a couple of weeks to let everything calm down, and hopefully that'll allow the House Intel Committee to have a fresh start on the Russia investigation.
What are you hearing about why he may have decided to step away from chairing this investigation?
Well, that's an interesting question because Nunes gave a couple of clues in his statement that he released Thursday saying that he would step away from the investigation. He said that, quote, left-wing activists had filed Ethics Committee charges against him, alleging that he had disclosed classified information when he came out and spoke to the press about viewing those documents. He said that while he believed he had still acted in complete good faith, he needed to step away because he was drawing attention to the investigation in the wrong matter. He was that classic Washington phrase of providing a distraction. So he said that he would step away but continue to be the House Intelligence Committee chair.
Who's chairing the committee now?
So a familiar face on the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Conaway from Texas, who is well-respected up on Capitol Hill. Conaway will take the lead on this Russia probe. What we know about him so far comes from the so far only public hearing into the House Russia investigation. That's when he got into a bit of a back and forth with FBI Director James Comey about whether Russia and Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win the U.S. presidency. He wanted to know if just because they didn't want Hillary Clinton to win, if that meant that they supported Donald Trump. He seemed to have trouble wrapping his head around the idea that Russia had indeed meddled in the U.S. election. So it'll be interesting to see the approach that he takes moving forward when the House comes back from that two-week recess at the end of April.
Do Democrats and others feel more comfortable now that this investigation can go forward in a fair way?
That's a great question, because even in the moments after Nunez recused himself, Democrats were already coming out and saying that while this was a good step for the House Intelligence Investigation, it still wasn't enough. And they're still calling for what they've said these past few weeks, is that an independent investigation along the lines of a 9/11 commission is still needed to provide the American public with full reassurance that we've really gotten to the bottom of this issue in terms of Russia meddling in the U.S. election. So it still remains to be seen if that Democrat call will be answered. For now, we have to see how the House Intelligence Committee moves forward with this leadership change.
All right, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, thanks so much. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Legendary American comedian Don Rickles, whose insults struck everyone in his path, from presidents right down to nightclub waiters, died on Thursday in Hollywood of kidney failure. He was 90 years old. The New York-born Rickles discovered his talent for comedy, entertaining his fellow sailors during World War II. After failing as an insurance salesman and encountering problems finding work as a serious actor, Rickles turned to comedy. He was short, bald, and stocky, and despite his hostile manner of comedy, no one who knew Rickles was really offended by his humor because they knew it was all in fun. Offstage, Rickles was known to be a gentle and considerate person. Here he is in 1974 at a Dean Martin roast for then-California Governor Ronald Reagan.
The greatest thing I can say to Governor Reagan or Regan, whatever they call, what do they call you, Governor? The greatest moment I remember in your career was when you said to Pat O'Brien, the Gipper is dying. And I got an uncle that thought it was a fish. Now the Gentile gentleman here had no idea, a kipper. That's a Jewish fish, don't be dumb, I hate a dumb guy.
Well, joining me now for social media reaction is Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew.
Absolutely. Calling Don Rickles the king of insult comedy and the celebrity roast. Very well known in the entertainment world for credits that people are remembering on social media, including The Twilight Zone, I Love Lucy, Gilligan's Island, Sanford and Son, and for many younger people, well known as the voice of Mr. Potato Head in Toy Story, in the
wow,
Toy Story franchise.
I did not know that.
Yes, so very well respected and remembered across the generations, and especially by other comedians who are pouring out their tributes on social media. David Letterman said he was such a professional and such a gentleman. Bob Newhart said he was one of the kindest, caring, and most sensitive human beings. And Tom Hanks simply said, a god died today. So someone who meant a lot in the comedic world and the entertainment world, someone who was able to sling insults at some of the biggest entertainment names in the world, Frank Sinatra, Johnny Carson, Jimmy Stewart, and someone who was known not only as a comedian but as a devoted husband. In fact, one nugget of information I thought was very interesting. He just sent out his first tweet about 3 weeks ago, and it was about his 52-year marriage to his wife and celebrating his anniversary 3 weeks
aww
ago. So not just for his contributions to comedy, but
so
also...
So he just started tweeting.
Yes.
Wow.
So also his contributions to as a devoted husband.
Anything else going on?
An interesting lawsuit that's brewing. Twitter is in the process of suing the Trump administration.
Wow.
Now, this is very interesting.
Really?
Back in March, the Trump administration asked for Twitter to reveal the name of someone who was tweeting anti-Trump information, particularly about the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. This Twitter account was saying some negative things, revealing negative information about Customs and Border Protection. And so the Trump administration asked Twitter to tell them who was tweeting this. Twitter is now suing them, saying that it is going beyond what the Trump administration should be requesting to ask Twitter to reveal one of their users. And this is something that we've talked about before that we're going to continue to see. We're seeing it now, the battle, regardless of the administration, the battle between government and these social media networks over security, privacy, information, and data. We talked about with the San Bernardino shooting back in 2015 that the government wanted to unlock the phone of one of the shooters. We've talked about how they've requested information about different people tweeting threats on Twitter or posting threats on Facebook. So this is a battle that we're going to continue to see, but this is the latest salvo we're seeing in that fight, this lawsuit against the Trump administration by Twitter.
All right. Well, we appreciate all your insights. Thanks so much, Andrew. Follow him at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And turning now to the world of music, Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to fill us in on some of the best moments, surprises, and big winners at the Academy of Country Music Awards.
Miranda Lambert's captivating, emotional, just chill-inducing performance, her emotional performance of a new song off of her album Weight of These Wings, Tin Man, which pretty much warns the Tin Man of The Wizard of Oz of the challenges of having a heart. But if he still wants one, he can have hers, and it's broken. So, like, the song itself will make you cry, let alone her performance of it. It resulted in a standing ovation. Yes.
Very impressive.
Yes. Another huge moment was when the Backstreet Boys took the stage with Florida Georgia Line. So they have a song together called God, Your Mama, and Me. They performed that, but then they segued into the Backstreet hit Everybody. And literally, everybody jumped on their feet in just pure joy and nostalgia and just had a great time. So it was like a mini party right in the middle of the party. So that was a lot of fun. And the look on Tim McGraw's face when he saw them break out in their dance moves went viral. It was priceless.
Well, tell us some of the surprises.
Okay, woo, a lot of surprises. Keith Urban, Blue Ain't Your Color, did not win. Keith Urban didn't win anything.
Oh, no.
Well, basically anything, because he won a little something, and I'll explain that later. But, not Record of the Year. He didn't win Record of the Year. Florida Georgia Line won that for Holy. And understandably, because that song did very well on the charts for a long time. And Song of the Year went to Thomas Rhett, Die a Happy Man. Now, I have an issue with this because last year, Thomas Rhett won for that song for Record of the Year. So this year he won Song of the Year. Last year he won Record of the Year. And I was like, they could have given it to someone else. They could have given it to Blue Ain't Your Color. So Keith Urban was robbed. And then also, this is wild, too. So Entertainer of the Year went to Jason Aldean. Now, nothing against Jason Aldean, but he won that exact award at the ACMs last year. They could have given it to Keith Urban. They could have given it to Carrie Underwood. Both of them have had a phenomenal year. So I was like, what, huh? I think he was even surprised by that. And then the same happened with Female Vocalist of the Year. Miranda Lambert is incredible. And she won and made history in the process by having the most consecutive wins, 8 to be exact. Even she went up to the mic and she said, Carrie Underwood can sing me under the bus. So, you know, and when she went up, she gave Carrie Underwood a hug. Obviously, she thought Carrie would win, and so did I. So I really, even though I'm happy for Miranda, I think Carrie was robbed. Wild.
Who would you say were the biggest winners?
I'm just going to say commercial country music, I think, was the overarching winner. So there were a lot of great artists that did great work this year that were nowhere to be acknowledged, not even as nominees or performers or presenters. So in that sense, I think the big winner was commercial country music. It was a commercial country party. And it was a good one, too.
Well, you can hear all kinds of country music, including commercially successful and or critically acclaimed, on VOA One's Country Hits, hosted by Nikki Strong. Feel free to share your thoughts about our discussion on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Hey there, Mr. Tin Man. You don't know how lucky you are. You shouldn't spend your whole life wishing for something bound to fall apart. Every time you're feeling empty,
you've been listening to International Edition on VOA. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. officials have condemned the bombing in St. Petersburg, Russia, that has left at least 14 people dead and scores injured. The bomb, believed to be a homemade device filled with shrapnel, tore through a subway car April 3rd. A second explosive device reportedly was found at a nearby subway station, but it was disarmed by authorities. Russian President Vladimir Putin said all possible motives, including terrorism, are being investigated. No individual or group has claimed responsibility for the attack. At a lunch meeting in Washington with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, President Trump called the bombing in St. Petersburg terrible. White House spokesperson Sean Spicer said the United States condemns this reprehensible act of violence. Our thoughts and prayers are with the injured and with the Russian people as we extend our deepest condolences to the loved ones who have been killed and injured. Attacks like these on ordinary citizens just going about their lives remind us that the world must work as one to combat violence in all forms, he added. The United States is prepared to offer assistance to Russia that it may require in investigating this crime. State Department Acting Spokesperson Mark Toner issued a written statement also condemning the attack and expressing condolences to the loved ones of those killed and injured. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley, in a statement, called the images of lives lost and people injured in St. Petersburg heartbreaking. Ambassador Haley said, "The United States will stand with Russia on defeating these extremists who continue to senselessly harm innocent people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is for